You're an electrician, too. You just didn't know.
Just need to verify that we're picking this up. And that, and I think we're... All right. Let me begin then by indicating that today is December 15th, and this is Jim Boning with Bernadette McNulty speaking with Irving Shapiro in his office in Wilmington, Delaware. Mr. Shapiro, I know that you were born in Minneapolis on the 15th July in 1916, and that your father was an immigrant from Lithuania. Could you tell me a little more about your parents and your family background?
Well, it was the typical family situation of people from Eastern Europe who migrated to the United States around the turn of the century. And by any definition, they had a rough time for many, many years before they finally got themselves at least minimally economically established so that they could live a decent life. As you know from the notes, my mother came over here, well, she didn't know this, my mother came over here at age 12 because both her parents died in the same year, and she was sent off to a short-tailed relative in New York, and wound up being given the living room sofa as her place to live, and somehow or other she wound up in the garment trade and spent some years just doing that. And fate, as fate would have it, she traveled out to Minnesota on a vacation to visit her brother, and lo and behold, she met my father, and it was a fast romance, and it all started. It's the typical story of coal and a half ton lots, just as one measure of how frugal things were. But there was always the feeling that opportunity was going to knock and they were going to be all right. And they were right, it did. My father wound up with a little business that supported the family, and as he became older, my younger brother took it over and it supported that family for a lot of years. So this is the classic American story.
How did your father end up in Minneapolis?
Well, that's a typical story again. My father got drafted into the Russian army. And for a fellow named Shapiro, that was not a very desirable thing to have happen. But he served his duty, and by the time he was discharged, the family had left to save the younger boys from a similar experience, and they wound up in Glasgow. And so he headed for Glasgow, and stayed about a week and decided that wasn't for him and he wanted to come to the States. And in those days particularly, when you're really penniless, you didn't choose where you wanted to live. You went wherever townspeople were. And it turned out there was a collection of townspeople in Minneapolis from his town. And so he headed there. And it was the established practice. Those there ahead of him looked out for him, saw that he had enough food and that sort of thing, and helped him get started. No more resourceful than that. And he managed to stay the rest of his life in that one spot.
Where did his interest in the law derive?
I can't really give you an answer to that. He had an interest in accounting, he had an interest in law, and he dabbled around with it. He loved lawyers. He really didn't have much legal business to parcel out, but he had a relationship with a couple of lawyers in the city, and Well, they had an interesting case. They invited him to come to court, lost them, and they'd give him all books that they no longer needed and that sort of thing. And he dabbled with it. Not sure he was ever really a first-class expert on the subject, but he knew the terminology, and he had an interest. And on the comic side, he was pretty good at keeping a set of books and knowing what he was doing. Double entry bookkeeping was not a mystery to him. And the thing, for me at least, that's significant is that in the early pictures of him, there were always some books on his desk. Not novels, but little law books, accounting books, that sort of thing. And he had obviously a great ambition to make something of himself. And I think the fair conclusion is that he didn't quite get to what he wanted to get to, and so he just transferred all that to his older son. And if I had to explain how I wound up in law school, my guess would be that he probably had a more subtle influence on me than anything else. But my own analysis is that I had no talent at all for the sciences. And I had a great talent for government, law, that kind of thing. And so it was just natural to go in the direction of where the abilities were.
So from little up, you remember your father in terms of the books and in terms of the...
In retrospect, I think in part he was kidding himself. The subjects were too complex to really master. But he would read a chapter on equity law, try to figure out what that was all about, and think he had accomplished something when he did it. And he was an interesting man in the sense that he had lots of different abilities. In those days, people resident in Minneapolis and wanted to write to relatives in Eastern Europe had to get someone who could address the envelope in the language of the country he was going to. And so my father had a steady stream of callers asking to have envelopes addressed for them. And the same, no matter what the language was, he had it under control and could do it. So my own judgment is that he's a man who probably ended up doing the wrong thing in his life. There were no opportunities, and he had no living. So that all got transferred. The eldest son did those things that he wanted to do.
You said that he was something. He had a subtle influence. Was he ever outspoken about it? Open way?
There was no pressure. I remember thinking very carefully about accounting as an alternate to law. Wasn't at all sure that I had the stuff to do law. And when I look back on it now, I'm very grateful that I never went for accounting. at that stage of life, when you're uncertain about your own abilities, and the driving force is to get some skill that will earn you a living, those were the alternatives. I knew that there was a segment over here involved government, law, subjects of that kind, which I had a pretty good natural flair, and the whole subject over here involving the sciences, in which I simply had no interest at all, and stayed away from every course on science I possibly could.
So your grade school education and high school education was near home then?
Yes.
And I understand that as children you worked in your father's business at school?
Well, some did more than others. I was a business that didn't attract me very much either. The idea of handling other people's dirty clothes fooling around that way was something you did, but not something I looked forward to, so I found as many excuses as possible to not go there. There were days, you know, weeks when I did, but my younger brother, for example, took to it like a duck to water, and he thought that it was a great operation. But I can remember going to summer school and college as one way of avoiding working in the plant.
As you were going through high school, did your thoughts turn more and more to a pre-law degree at the University of Minneapolis, or what were your thoughts?
Well, at that time, it became very clear to me that subjects like botany, biology, were something I endured. But when I got to subjects like civics, which was government, really, it was as though someone turned on a light. And I really functioned as the assistant teacher. It became that easily to me. And the same thing was true in a bookkeeping course I took, in which another fellow and I simply ran away with the whole course, and the rest of the class was way behind us. I mean, it just came to us naturally. And so that began to give me the thought that I'd better figure out where my talents were, to the extent that I had any. And as I said, clearly they were not in the scientific area, but they were in the area of governmental functioning and all the things that relate to government. So by the time college came, I simply signed up for the pre-law course and got turned on by English constitutional history, of all things, and took all of that I could get in, and was fascinated by the whole development of the common law, and ultimately got to law school, and I had no idea whether I'd last. In those days, at that school at least, policy was, if you met minimal qualifications, you were admitted. And 75% of the students were flunked out at the end of the first year. And so I figured, well, I've got 1 year to see whether I can cut the mustard or not. And if not, I guess it'll be accounting. And lo and behold, at the end of the first quarter, we took exams. And when the grades were posted, I was number 4 in a class of 133. And so for the first time, the light went on. I said to myself, maybe I've got more going here than I realized. And then I really got involved heavily in trying to keep up that kind of performance, and I did. And so I didn't have any doubts at all that I was in the right field. But that was a world in which, despite what anybody may tell you, the driving force was economic. You had to be able to earn money because there wasn't any around. And I've often thought if someone had come around and given me a job in that period with cash, queried whether I would have ever remained in college. But in any event, I did the law school bit and did it very effectively. Made the order of the coif and all the rest, and graduated. And the question was to get some law firm to hire me. And Minneapolis was a very inhospitable place for young lawyers. The major law firms wanted nobody with a name like mine. There were two law firms that would interview, but they were overwhelmed by all the Jewish graduates each year coming out of the law school. So that really wasn't much of an opportunity. And I finally caught up with a retired IRS agent who was practicing tax law. And he said, well, if you want to come in with me, I'll give you an office. And you can get any business on your own, you take care of it. And when you've got free time, do work for me. And that's how I got started. And I can remember very vividly, I got a title on an empty lot to do some work on. Lo and behold, I found a defect in the title and got it corrected. And the bill was $15, and that was a lot of money in those days.
Were there any people during your either high school or college career who influenced you in any way?
Well, the influential people were the faculty people at the law school. The law school opened a world for me that I'd never known existed. I've been sheltered from the judicial system, from the great judges and all the rest. And once I started pawing around in that literature, sure, I was turned on in a big way. Justice Holmes, Brandeis, Cardozo, people of that quality. And I really fell in love with the legal system and the people in it. Now, in retrospect, I'm clear that I went overboard, and not everybody in it was great. And I found a test on that at a later, much later point in time when I moved from being a lawyer to being a corporate executive. I had some concerns about whether feeling as I did about the great legal lights, I feel the same. I feel uncomfortable in the business world. And of course, what I discovered, not surprisingly at all when you think about it, is that there were some great people in the business world too, and I took to them just the same way. Didn't say every businessman was great, but those who were an exciting group. And just to get ahead of the thing a little bit, in my early days as a lawyer, I was at the Department of Justice and wound up as a Supreme Court lawyer. I never tried a lawsuit in my life, but I was writing briefs for the Supreme Court, and finally I said, well, go ahead and argue your own case. And so I had a string of appearances in the Supreme Court and in the various courts of appeal before I'd ever tried a lawsuit, which is exactly an upside-down procedure. But I'd had this exposure to the justices of the Supreme Court on a daily basis, and that sort of was the role model for greatness, at least with respect to some of them. And I was quite pleasantly surprised to find that there were the same kind of people in the business community. And so we were off to the races after that.
Just to go back for a minute.
Sure.
I was wondering how you funded your way through college.
Well, there are two stages. The pre-law part of it involved tuition of $26 a quarter, and I lived at home, and so all I needed was money for books and transportation. Streetcar was 10 cents from home to the campus. And lots of time they managed to bum rides from people who had cars, so that I got by with a minimum of money. And what I did get by with essentially came from my father. I picked up a little money doing some jobs when I could find them, but not much really. When I got to law school, it was different. I was eligible to borrow $200 a year, loan, my signature, interest-free, and start bearing interest after I graduated. And with $200, I owned the world. I could support all my needs, and I can remember clearly the feeling of great self-respect because somebody would give me money simply on my signature. That never before happened in my life that anybody took me as a serious individual. But it worked, and then I can remember clearly the first thing I did when I started earning money was to pay off the law school on my loans on the theory that that money better be there for somebody else coming along. That's how it happened. I didn't know I didn't have money.
You got your law degree in 1941 and then went to work with this tax lawyer. I'm not clear the dates of war. Pearl Harbor was December of 1941. Were you still working in Minneapolis at that time?
Yes. Well, got a time frame here. Graduated in June. Took the bar over the summer. Got admitted to the bar in September. And then I worked with this man from September to early December when Pearl Harbor, they changed everything. And at that point, I was recruited by someone from the federal government. Said they got my name from the dean of the law school, but anyhow, there's a national emergency. Drop whatever you're doing and come to Washington. And I talked it over with the man with whom I was associated. He said, by all means, you know, this is the thing you should do. Decide you're going to get drafted anyhow, so go get that job done and then you'll be in the military. And so in 3 or 4 days I was in Washington. And it's hard to believe now, but I remember arriving by train in the morning, and I was supposed to report for work that morning, and came out of the train station, and there was the Capitol. And I couldn't resist checking my bags and just walking around the Capitol and admiring it before I showed up for work.
You were involved in developing the wartime rationing systems then?
Yes, yeah.
At the OPA?
Yes.
What did that involve?
Well, what you have to visualize is a large bullpen filled with lawyers and administrators, maybe 100 people on a floor, and they're divided up into groups. One's worrying about sugar, another worrying about tires, a third is automobiles, and bicycles, and different groups. And what you're trying to do is to put together a rationing program that would conserve what stocks we had and set priorities for who had access to them. I remember sugar was the first one I worked on. A group that was sitting around the room trying to figure out a sugar rationing program that could be put in place very quickly. And the problem that arose was that the government printing office needed 90 days to print the rationing coupons. And one of the greatest lessons I ever had, I sat there and everybody's talking, arguing back and forth, and one of the fellows sitting there not saying anything, just folding paper. And he got it in this shape, and then he wrote something on each side. And this page was printed coupons, which the housewife would clip off to use. And it took about 2 days to print all this up and get it going. So we got the program out very quickly, and I've always remembered the fact that one man with some imagination made the whole thing go. And so I learned a large lesson that day. Well, it went on like that. We set up a rationing program for automobiles. We excluded luxury cars because no one cared about them. And the definition of a luxury car was any car that sold for more than $2,000.
Which is, I understand, it was your salary, your initial salary there. Is that correct?
Yeah. That was my first introduction to the world of finance, and I was perfectly satisfied with $2,000 a year until I discovered that the guys working the desk next to me were making a lot more money than I was. And that had a logical explanation. They were older, and so they fell into different groupings, but I didn't understand that and couldn't understand why people doing the same work are getting different compensation. But the fact is that $2,000 was enough to live comfortably. We got married. My wife went to work. We saved her earnings. And with $2,000, we had everything we wanted. In those days, you could buy a steak dinner for $1.25.
I understand also that Richard Nixon was at the desk next to you at one point.
Yeah, he was. We had a setup in which we had an auto rationing group here, a tire rationing group here, and as fate would have it, there were all the jurisdictional squabbles. And so they took Nixon and said, "You be the arbiter. You work between the two groups and keep peace." And he was a pleasant, inoffensive guy. He stayed there until he went into the Navy, and then when he came out, he came back, and at that point, he had been elected to Congress. His wife was pregnant with her first child, and they needed help in terms of identifying a doctor and all those things, and the team he had worked with went to work, and one fellow had a father who was politically tied in, so he introduced Nixon to Senator Taft, and the senator got on his committee assignments. Another sent Mrs. Nixon to the gynecologist that his wife used, and that's how the small little world blossomed.
When did the draft catch up with you?
Well, let's see if I can put a time frame around it. I would guess probably within a year of the time we came to Washington. I'm not certain of that, but in that range, because we had a small apartment and I managed to sell all the furniture in the apartment, provided I was drafted. And then I went out to Fort Snelling in Minnesota to report. And they took one look at me and they said, "We're not that desperate." I'd had a history of asthma as a child, and the Army didn't want anybody with that kind of background. And so I came back to Washington and worked for a while longer at the OPA, and I decided that was really the wrong place if you wanted to learn to be a good lawyer. I was getting along fine doing what I was doing, but that wasn't a demanding lawyer's role, so I went over to the Department of Justice and canvassed the place, and sure enough, there was a job opening in the criminal division in their appellate section. And I figured, well, why not? And I went over. Started writing Supreme Court briefs. And the first thing I discovered was that everybody else wrote so much better than I did. And it was a style of writing those things. And it was really pretty backward in terms of their level of skill. And an interesting footnote to life. And so I started examining, how the Supreme Court justices write, what's their style. I finally wound up trying to write the way Justice Frankfurter wrote. The trouble with that was that it might take me a week to do something and take someone else a day to do the same thing. And so I knew that I was on the wrong track. One night, I had to get a brief ready to submit to the Solicitor General's staff for review. And the practice there was that they were a superior group of lawyers, and they usually rewrote everything you submitted anyhow. But I took the stuff home, looked at it, and decided I didn't like anything I'd written, and I simply threw it in the wastebasket. And I'm going to start over again. And I'm going to write it as though Irving Shapiro writes, not Justice Frankfurter. And I was up most of the night writing that brief and longhand. Lo and behold, it was submitted to the Solicitor General staff and passed without a change being made in it. And went to the Supreme Court, and certiorari was denied, so I prevailed. And, that was the first time it really dawned on me that you can't be somebody else. You've got to be yourself. You've got to play to your own strengths and not try to fake it. And so after that, there was never a problem. After that, I knew I could write. And with time, the skill got better. And toward the end of my period of justice, when I was engaged in trial work, the trial lawyers looked on me as the great brief writer, and whenever the thing to be written for any court, they ducked and passed it on to me because I wrote so much better than they did. So it was a good lesson in finding yourself, really.
I'm not sure if this was early on in your time at Justice or not, but I understand you were given a case that looked like a real loser.
Yeah, that's the first Supreme Court argument. You write briefs, and then someone else goes up to the court and argues the case, and you go up to observe, and your tongue just hangs out at the opportunity to say these things yourself. You wrote them. It was not then the custom for the Solicitor General to send anybody to the court to argue, other than people on his own staff. And that was a select group of 8 or 10 people. But in this case, they thought they had a losing position. Paul Freund, who was a great man at Harvard, but then was the Assistant Solicitor General, why don't we give Shapiro a chance to get some experience? Let him go up and argue. I seized the opportunity, absolutely frightened out of my wits, but seized the opportunity and prepared the best I could. Granted my cutaway and the whole bit. The day came to argue the case, and you had to be in court 2 cases before your case, sitting in the Weller Court waiting your turn. And the night before was no sleep, sat in the courtroom listening to other arguments. And the great worry was that I would open my mouth and nothing would come out. And such as that. What do you do? And then to put the pressure on, it was a very important antitrust case that was going to be argued following my case. And so the well of the court was filled with prominent litigating lawyers from New York and Washington. And my case is called. I walk up to the dais. surrounded by all these experienced lawyers. There's a court in front of me. Look, I'll say the usual things and get started in the argument. And lo and behold, there's a dialogue with the court almost immediately. And it's clear there are two factions on the court on the issues here. And within 5 minutes, I concluded that my prepared stuff was academic, and I better close my books and deal with the members of the court answering their questions. And I did that for a solid hour. The verdict of those in the courtroom was that I'd done a good job. And so I felt pretty good about myself. And I lost on a 5-3 vote, but most people didn't think I could get 3 votes. So the word went out in Washington, this kid is all right. And from then on, I was practicing in the court on a regular basis. It became routine. So it's an interesting beginning. I never tried a lawsuit. Here I was. I had argued one case in the Court of Appeals, and my second appearance was in the Supreme Court, and under circumstances in which I knew everybody expected me to lose, but my theory was that arguing even a losing case is better than not arguing a case. So I went in, gave it all I had, and got a good, strong, dissenting opinion, and that was the beginning.
You also argued a case in the civil rights area at one point. Is that correct?
Well, I didn't argue it. I was on the brief. One of the famous civil rights cases arose in Georgia. The sheriff arrested a young black boy, brought him to the area of the jail, and strung him up on a tree and hung him. And the district court, there was an indictment, and the district court said that this wasn't state action. This was the sheriff who got out of line on his own, and so there was no federal lawsuit. They took an appeal to what was then the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, and that's when I got in to write the brief, and we failed. The Court of Appeals said the state didn't authorize him to hang this boy, so there's no federal cause of action. And at that point, we said we just got to go to the Supreme Court, and we wrote the best brief we could, and the Supreme Court agreed to review the case and reversed. It said, obviously, when you put a man in public office surrounded with the power of the sheriff, the state can't walk away and say his actions were not state actions. And so we established that principle way back in the 40s that really became a foundation for a lot of the civil rights action that came later. And I once had a very interesting experience because of all that. I was being honored by one of the black organizations in New York, and they said, come on, and we want to honor you, and you don't have to make a speech or anything. And lo and behold, by the time things came to a head, of course I had to make a speech, and I had nothing prepared. And so I decided the best way to deal with this was to tell them the story of the Screws case. It was basically a black audience of lawyers and judges, business people, and I walked them through the facts and told them the dilemma of a young lawyer. No, he stands for justice, but what is justice in dealing with this kind of a problem? I told them the case in the Supreme Court and the ultimate outcome. One of the black judges from the Court of Appeals in Philadelphia was in the audience, and I could see him nudge his partner and say, United States versus Scrooge. And everybody identified with what I had gone through and felt very warm about the fact that they could salute me. Well, and that's much ado about writing a brief. I didn't even qualify to argue the case. But that was one where you felt that somebody had to do something about something as outrageous as that. And we finally got it done. And I want to leave the impression that it would just be there are two or three of us who felt the same way. We applied ourselves to the case, and we prevailed. But in those days, the whole civil rights operation in Washington was five lawyers. Mm-hmm. That's how long ago that was.
In 1948, you were put on the prosecution team for the trial of 11 communists.
Yeah.
Who was responsible for putting you on that group?
Well, let me give you some background, and I'll answer that question. For reasons beyond my knowledge, a decision had been taken at the higher level of the government to bring a Smith Act case against the leaders of the Communist Party. And for reasons that I can only speculate about, the U.S. attorney in New York, who was to try the case, refused to use his own staff on the case. Now, I could speculate on why that was, but in any event, that was the case. And so Washington had to recruit a team to do the job, and my first inkling was simply a summons to the front office and a statement that I was going to New York and assigned to this case. And at that point, I had a young wife with a young son and a daughter who had just been born, and it wasn't very happy to live, but that was the order. And I'd never been to New York, so that at that point, you know, I had to ask questions about hotel, where do you live, and all the rest. But in any event, we got organized, and there was a team pulled together, and couple of other fellows who were really quite good, had been former assistant U.S. attorneys, and I brought one fellow from Washington with me, and we started working our way through all kinds of materials that the FBI had assembled, and none of it made a lot of sense. The FBI taken in by all the communist literature and thought that that was very important, and anybody who had seen a courtroom knew you weren't going to get very far talking about any book regardless of what the subject matter was. And so we got to the point where we realized that the FBI had informants, live people. We insisted on seeing those people and interviewing them. And I remember one interview was conducted in a car driving on Long Island roads. There was an FBI agent driving the car, and I seated in the back seat with a man from Boston who turned out ultimately to be a star witness. And so we got our facts organized in a sensible way, and we went before a grand jury and presented them. Bought in the indictment. Everybody sort of laughed and said, communists are much too strong in this country for you to be able to really achieve success. And we literally had potential witnesses who refused to testify because they said, you can't beat the communists. You're going to expose me and ruin me forever. But we got involved in a 9-month trial, and we got it accomplished. And at that point, I inherited the case for appellate purposes, and everybody else disappeared from the scene. And so I put together a new team to handle the appeals, and we argued the case in the Second Circuit for 3 mornings, which is quite unusual. The court assessed that 3 mornings to hear the case, and then Judge Lerner hand wrote the opinion. And so I had all kinds of victories. We won the case. I had an opinion by the greatest judge in the country, and I had the privilege of arguing before him and experiencing the man. So I thought this was great. And then, of course, the case got to the Supreme Court, and the Attorney General had assigned himself the case to argue. So my function was to prepare everything for him, which I did. And at the last minute, he got buck fever and ducks. And it's one thing to theorize about these things, but to face 9 justices in a complex case like this without knowing the details of the evidence, he decided prudence required that he be busy someplace else. And so the Solicitor General and I split the argument up, and I took the fact part of the case, and he took the constitutional issues, and we argued in the Supreme Court. And by the time the decision came down, I had already left the Department of Justice and come to the top. So I got the word here.
During the time this trial was going on, that was also the beginning of the McCarthy era, too, wasn't it?
Yeah. I think the McCarthy era began a little before the case, because at least if you include the House Un-American Activities Committee as part of the picture.
Okay.
Because I remember writing a brief in the Supreme Court about the committee. But that was the period, and there were strong feelings, but the press, the area that columnists were writing, the whole case was a fake, couldn't get a conviction, and this was just Truman's show for the 1948 election. We didn't know you couldn't win. I mean, same to us, if you could get the evidence we wanted, you had a shot at convincing a jury what you're talking about. We turned up some confidential informants the FBI had who were really quite good. Once you got them before the jury, then everybody's attitude changed. So it's the old story. You know, you can't win without facts. You've got to have live witnesses. And fortunately, we had a good judge in Harold Medina. And so it was a long struggle, but we finally got the verdict. And the judge locked all the defendants up. Pending sentencing, and they had a lot of applications for bail. He turned them all down. And my boss in this case, the U.S. attorney, took the view that they ought to be locked up, not on bail, pending appeal. And at that juncture, I came home one weekend to see my wife and kids. And I got a call from the Attorney General and said, would you please come to my home Sunday afternoon, 2 o'clock? Sure. I went there, lo and behold, the White House was represented there by Clark Clifford. And the long and the short of it was applause for getting a conviction, but was it really necessary to keep these people locked up pending appeal? And I love is how, as a Supreme Court lawyer, I knew that this was a case going to the Supreme Court, and therefore there was a good case for saying put him out on bail until the Supreme Court concludes. And well, they didn't want the administration to take the heat for making that concession. And so they said, go argue this thing in the Second Circuit, but don't tell anyone I'm going to release him on bail. Let them come to that conclusion on their own. Well, that was a pretty hard assignment. And I went into the court and argued it, and Judge Hand again was on the panel. And I started my little dance, trying to tell him that we expected him to let him out on bail but not make the concession. And finally, Hand looked at me and said, "Counsel, do you concede that there is an issue for a resolution by the Supreme Court?" Typical thing you do on a buy time. I just quickly said, "Your Honor, that puts the question to me in a hard way." He said, "I intended to." And of course, they knew what the game was, and they entered an order, as a matter of fact, saying on the basis of the concessions made by the government, bail is appropriate, set bail. It's an interesting footnote, just to divert for a second. There's a book out now on Learned Hand and His Life, which is a marvelous book. And the author has a little section on this particular episode, and he characterizes the government attorney's argument before the panel as not very clear. And the court had granted bail, and that was a compliment. He didn't know it, but that was a compliment. Well, we wandered pretty far, but it's interesting history.
No, that's great. You had reached, by this point, you had reached a position which was, as I understand it, the highest career job you could get without getting a political appointment. Is
yes.
that correct? And what were your thoughts at that point in terms of your career?
Well, I knew I didn't have any political backing, and so I probably had to take the initiative and lead justice. I hadn't done anything about it. And I hadn't even settled on which law firm to try, anything like that. But while arguing this communist case in the Court of Appeals, the New York Times had carried a full story on the argument each day. And I got a call at the courthouse. It was from a man I had worked with at Justice for a few months, and he'd gone on and joined the DuPont legal department and risen, and he said, "Would you have lunch with me?" I did. He said, "You got to make a move. You've gone as far as you're going at Justice. Why don't you think about joining the DuPont legal department, and we can have some fun together, do some things." To make a long story short, I went in and interviewed the general counsel. I said, "I want to make sure you understand I have no scientific education at all. And I just wonder whether I'm a fit for a science-based company." smiled and said, if I need a scientist, I can hire a scientist. I need a lawyer who understands the law of conspiracy. I said, well, I understand law of conspiracy. That's not a challenge. And so I got hired, and the thing that really was very attractive was the government was paying me $10,000 a year and could up the ante to 12. And I said to myself, well, you know, $2,000 is $2,000, but there's even the chance that there might be more money later. Who knows? So I took the opportunity. My problem at that moment was they wanted an antitrust lawyer. You know, I had never read the Sherman Act. I was a criminal lawyer. And so I bought an antitrust casebook and holed up in the hotel room for 6 weeks and just worked my way through the book and then pronounced myself an antitrust expert. And it works.
Before you accepted the job at DuPont, did you come to Wilmington and interview with the legal department?
Oh, yes.
Was there any concern about your being a Jew in terms of joining that department?
There turned out to be. The first round was one in which the general counsel recommended the appointment, and someone on the executive committee of the company responsible for personnel refused to approve the appointment, and so it fell to my friend to come see me in Washington and tell me the sorry tale, and it was a crushing blow, but that's life. So, I'd go on living, and really a year or two later, and he came back and said, now I can guarantee it can be done. Please say you'll do it. And it turned out that the VP who had been the culprit had retired, and his replacement. So the only question I've got is, this guy is as good as you say he is. Maybe we ought to try to keep him in Washington. But in any event, I came in, the thing that made it workable for me was that with my name, there was no mystery at all. And lo and behold, nobody paid any attention. I found a setting in which there were a handful of Jewish lawyers who had been there for years, but they were all anonymous. They made their charitable gifts anonymously. They didn't admit their background. The point of this is not that so much, but rather Harvard Greenwald had become chairman of the company. And someone got to him and said, do you realize what's going on in your company? There's a sense out there that the company is hostile to Jewish people. And I have to say in all candor that the largest business DuPont had was the textile fibers business, and Jewish people were all over that business and were major customers. And so Crawford stepped up to it, and he wrote a letter for quiet publication that disavowed the past and proclaimed a new era for the future. It turned out to be true. I think that Crawford simply never thought in terms like that. I think the DuPont brothers did. But in any event, there I was. And it happens in life sometimes. One of the early people to become an admirer of me was Walter Carpenter, who had been the CEO prior to Crawford Greenwald. This was a fascinating experience because he was a very sophisticated, bright, knowledgeable person.
He was addressed as Mr. Carpenter by everybody, including the top command. And he got into sort of a little game with me. He knew the legal department started at 8:30 in the morning, so at 8 o'clock he'd leave a call for me. And then he got in the habit of wanting to hear a discussion of Supreme Court decisions. Decisions came out on Monday and Tuesday morning. He was on the phone telling me what this case means and why. And so we developed a relationship. And finally, one morning, he said, Mr. Shapiro, my name is Walter. I said, well, in those circumstances, you can call me Irv. And we became, you know, very good friends on a business basis. And he had great respect for me. And I'm sure it made a difference in how others saw me. But that was the beginning of the brood up. I'm not sure he triggered it, but I'm sure that when people mentioned my name, said, what do you think? He said, you know, this guy's all right. And that was the beginning of Perseal's all right.
Carpenter, if I remember correctly, had married one of the DuPonts. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes. No, that's not correct. His brother had.
Oh, okay.
Carpenter had not. Carpenter had married a woman who had been working for one of the DuPont families. But his brother, Rudy Carpenter, had been tied to Pierre DuPont, and Rudy married one of Pierre's sisters.
When did you first meet some of the DuPonts? Was it through Walter Carpenter that you met others?
No. My relationship with Walter Carpenter was one-on-one, and never went beyond that. After I was in the saddle for a while, I found myself assigned to the what we called the General Motors litigation with the antitrust case in Chicago to force DuPont to get out of its investment in General Motors. And we had a big team in Chicago, and part of my assignment was to stay back in Wilmington and make sure that the top management of the company knew on a daily basis what was happening and understood the significance of it, pro or con. And I drew that straw for a while. I went out to Chicago later, but in any event, every day I met with the key people on the executive committee and gave them a rundown of the previous day's developments. And they began to feel free to call me when they had anything on their mind. And before long, they saw me as their lawyer. And when we won in Chicago, they had all rubbed off. I thought they had a pretty good horse. And when we were through with the case, I represented various of the industrial departments and had a curious experience. My function in life was to solve their problems, and very often they come in with a proposed course of action that clearly was illegal. And say, well, you know, if you've got this kind of a problem, you can't do it this way, but let's think about alternative courses of action. And maybe you can't get 100% of what you're after, but can you live with 70% or 80%? And usually I gave them two or three alternatives of action, and they'd select one, and it worked. And so pretty soon the word went out that this guy is different from all the other lawyers. Then I found myself being invited to sit in on the staff meetings of the industrial department heads whose legal work I did, which was a signal to their people that this guy was okay. And after a while, it was an accepted fact. And you get a call from one of the business people saying, I got a legal problem. You come down, he didn't have a legal problem at all. He had a business problem, and he was looking for help. And I discovered that somehow or other, I had some business judgments that I could apply, and it helped him solve his problem. And finally, the manager just said, you're now functioning as a businessman anyhow. Why don't you stop pretending you're a lawyer? Come on over to the business side of things. And so at that point, I was an assistant general counsel of the department. And I got jumped 4 or 5 grades, I guess, and made a vice president of the company and member of the executive committee. And it was significant for two reasons. The first was that it had never before happened to a lawyer in DuPont. And secondly, no one in the history of the company had jumped that far in one step. And there were people who had concerns about whether I was ready for something like that. And I was one of them. Well, I figured you can't say no to an opportunity like that. You've got to give it a shot and see if you can make it work. And so I came on the committee, and didn't take long to get convinced that these are all great fellas, but they also put their trousers on one leg at a time, and they didn't know any better answers than I knew. And so it got to the point where I had built a following as a guy who could solve the tough problems. And then the rest of the story, you know. At one point, I was simply told that if I would take it, I was going to succeed Ralph McCoy as CEO of the company. That was so far from anything I'd ever thought of that I asked for a tablet and a pen, and I want to write this down so I can get it right. And there it was. And once I took over, it seemed to me the job is pretty well defined. I didn't have to be a scientist to do the job. I had to be a fella who understood the people and had the support of the people in the organization, who understood the political scene on the outside, the press scene and all the rest, and who had some ideas about direction. Somehow it all came together and worked. I think in part it worked because DuPont had been a very closed-in company. While the family ran it, secrecy was a word, and they didn't want the press anywhere near them and all the rest. And the world had changed, and my view of the world was that the press could be our ally if we did it the right way. And I made it a point of always talking to reporters directly, never turning them down, and never lying to them. If something came up that I couldn't talk about, I told them, I can't talk to you now about this, but when it opens up and I can, I'll talk to you. And I established my credibility, both in government circles and with the press. And that made an enormous difference. Once you open the windows and let some fresh air in, all kinds of things changed. And I capped that off. The business roundtable draft me to head the business roundtable. And that was still in its fledgling days, but it was inconceivable to anybody who tried to rationalize it. A guy named Shapiro would become the spokesman for all of American industry, and they would listen. But they did, and it all worked. And so the one great dividend out of that, that sort of gets lost in the shuffle, but which is important, is that if it was good enough for DuPont, it was suddenly good enough every place else. And within a couple of years, I could give you a list of 300 Jewish men who were in the top circles of American corporations. And today, it's not even a newsworthy event. And so, you know, in a quiet, simplistic way, a great thing was accomplished, totally apart from running the business.
Could I go back to some of the early days in the legal department? You said you had done some things before you were assigned to the antitrust case, is that correct? Or when you first went there,
well,
right on that case?
No, I came in and functioned as an antitrust lawyer and wrote opinions. For example, there was a question about whether DuPont's position on nylon was monopolistic. And so I did an elaborate study of nylon and concluded that it was not a monopoly, an illegal monopoly. And I ought to relax about that. There were other assignments like that, and then the system changed, and each industrial department was given a lawyer as its lawyer. And I drew a couple of interesting departments, and one of them invited me to speak at its sales meeting. And I thought about it. I finally hit on a theme, and the theme was this: Louis Brandeis, when he practiced law in Boston, represented a lot of major power companies, and he had a session with his clients, and the nuts of it was, gentlemen, if you insist on walking along the edge of a precipice, I can't tell you when you'll fall off, but I can tell you you will fall off. On the other hand, if you'll tell me what your objectives are, perhaps I can find a different route that will solve your problem with no risk of falling off the precipice. Well, that was a marvelous experience, and so I addressed this gung-ho sales group and said, you fellows have an image of a lawyer as a guy who learned to say no to you. It's not constructive. And I want to tell you, I'm a different kind of lawyer. And I went through the Brandeis thing and said, that's how I feel. If you'll tell me what you're up to, I can help you solve your problems. But if you keep me in the dark, I can't be of much use to you. And next thing that happened was the head of the department was getting touched with the general counsel saying, you finally got a lawyer in your place. And that was the start of it. And I work closely with the clients. I attended the staff meetings. I conducted sample surveys that went on in their files. I attended all the sales meetings, that sort of thing, and built the relationship with the people. And as they moved up in the business, they remembered who I was. And so, you know, it was that kind of thing. Before, well, I guess early on, I was involved briefly in the cellophane monopoly litigation as well. But the big thing came with the General Motors case in Chicago.
It's my understanding that you were
you directed the final settlement in terms of the divestiture not being counted as capital gains as opposed to regular income as a stockholder.
Well, I've more than just I. We undertook a campaign to convince the Congress that it was prohibited to tax our stockholders on an ordinary income basis on a forced divestiture. And this was a struggle for several years. And our real problem, it turned out, that we had a Senator John Williams here in Delaware who was setting up the roadblocks. The rest of the Senate leadership was ready to move on. And I can't be sure, but I think Senator Williams, who came from downstate Delaware, just wanted a socket to the DuPont family. He didn't care about the other stockholders. And so we finally worked out a plan in which the family people paid a tax on receipt of the stock, and all the other stockholders simply got it and reduced the cost basis for their DuPont stock. And so Williams got his pound of flesh, and it turned out not to be that painful for the family because that gave for even to move the stock without tax consequences later. So they paid taxes sooner. The state of Delaware wound up with a huge fund that came from the taxes the state got on this, and we managed to create a reserve fund to be used for important unforeseen developments in the state, and that lasted a few years. The politician got through that, but in any event, the problem was to not penalize the routine stockholder for this. The fact was that the DuPont family had prospered very well on the General Motors investment, and paying the tax was not the worst thing in the world, but it wasn't the same for the average stockholder. He may have bought a stock 2 weeks ago, and sock him with taxes at that point was brutal. So we got to work on it.
What was your relationship with Crawford Greenwald? What kind of person was he to work with?
Well, it started in a setting in which I was much closer to Walter Carpenter and known Crawford, but not really close to him at all. And occasionally I'd get called in on some problem and I'd give him advice and almost always say no. And all right, and my function in life was to give the advice, not to impose it on anybody. And then I began to notice that some months later, after he thought about it for a while, his views changed, and he started implementing the things that I had urged. And I never said anything to him about that. He never said anything to me about it. But we obviously both understood what was happening. And so, from my standpoint, it was an educational process. And gradually, obviously, we became much closer, but in a formal kind of a way. And it wasn't until Merle McCoy took over that I really blossomed on DuPont's ninth floor. And in between that, you had Lamont DuPont Copeland. But McCoy really didn't know me very well, but he knew me by reputation, and he took a shine to me. And then a peculiar thing happened, and these are the kind of the thing that you can never plan ahead of time. Burrell Nader used to have teams of college kids he set up, send them in to investigate a company for a summer. In 1 year, he was going to do it with Citicorp and with DuPont. Burrell McCoy was on the Citicorp board, it became a big issue there, and they brought in their law firm, Lawson and Moran, and finally a great plan was produced, and DuPont had played differently, and McCoy called me and said that we're going to have to face this. You better be the guy who runs it and tell me how you plan to do it. And quite innocently, I sat down, figured out a plan of action, presented it to him. And he said, my goodness, this is exactly the plan that this great law firm in New York presented to Citicorp. Well, not surprising. Good lawyers are going to think the same way. But in any event, that fixed it in his mind. He had one man who was the equivalent of this team of great lawyers in New York. And so we fought that battle quite successfully. And by then, I was on the executive committee. And then he looked to me for an objective judgment. He knew I had no irons in the fire. That, as a matter of fact, it didn't ever occur to me that I was a candidate for anything more. As a matter of fact, I wasn't quite sure why I got on the committee. But at least I made myself useful on the committee in some constructive ways. And McCoy, with the concurrence of Greenwald and Carpenter, decided I was the guy to succeed him. There was no one more surprised than I.
Could you tell us a little bit more about the Nader case?
Well, sure. The Nader affair was the typical case in which you arrive at a judgment first and then you look for facts to justify your judgment. And they picked a half a dozen kids and they took up residence in Wilmington for the summer. And they wanted to examine all kinds of DuPont files and all kinds of DuPont people. And indeed, they did it in the surrounding area, too. But the conditions I laid down for the interview was simply we would set a schedule and we would record the interviews so there'd be a record. They gave us the names they wanted. I produced those people, made a record of it. They objected vigorously that this was an interference with free speech to record what people said. Go away, you know, waste our time. And they were innocent kids, mostly. There were one or two that simply had a lot of baggage to carry, but it was a lark for them. They went around the barber shop, for example, and asked the barber whether I tipped decently and things like that. And the whole town rallied around us, and wherever they went, all they got was positive information, even if they had to stretch things a little bit. And so they wound up writing a report that was obviously negative, but was intended to be negative from the beginning. And what we did was, McCoy and I sat down and said, well, there's no way we can deal with this by just saying we disagree with them. Let's go through this material and find some gross errors and put out an error sheet immediately. That urges anybody who reads that report. And that turned out to be a 10 strike. The local press, the press generally, didn't pay much attention to it, but I wound up on the Phil Donahue show some years later, and he was playing the same game. He confronted me and said, this is what Mr. Nader said, and what is your response to that? And all I said was, Phil, we have tapes of all the interviews, and you're welcome to listen to the tapes. when the report came out, we put out an error sheet that said, here are fundamental factual errors in this report. You're welcome to see the error sheet. After you've gone through that material, then we can have a rational discussion about NATO. And well, that was far beyond anything he was up to. But the error sheet, you know, had credibility with everybody. You know, you wouldn't do that unless you thought you were right. The NATO thing was a flim-flam, and it was played for publicity. I've heard from some of those kids since then, and I straightened out, became fine citizens. One of them is general counsel now for Fidelity Investments. Another one wrote, thought he'd like to be a trustee of the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, of which I'm chairman, and wrote to me asking me to get him appointed. So, you know, it's a small world, and you have to recognize that kids are kids, and they have to grow up, and they were enamored with Nader, but they got good.
McCoy became president in 68, I believe, 1st of January, or the end of 67, somewhere
around that period.
And then you went on the executive committee in 70. Had there been other lawyers or legal counsel on the executive committee?
Never.
That was the first time.
That was the first time. No lawyer had ever been allowed in the business before. They all stayed as lawyers and functioned as lawyers, period.
You had used the term client before. It sounds like the legal department sat there and, as a law firm, and served the company.
Well, that's how I visualized it, that it was no different than if I were in private practice. If I had a client who had a problem, my job was to solve the problem. And the only difference really was that I couldn't bill him. I did indirectly because it became part of the cost of the operation, but I went at it on the basis that I was in private practice and these were important clients.
Do you feel that you're the more behind the scenes interaction is giving advice to the management as opposed was more of an influence in your rise as opposed to your work on the GM?
Well, you can't separate them out. Each played a role. I'll give you one, for instance, just to dramatize the thing. One of our industrial departments that supplies the automotive industry got into a dispute with Ford. The Ford lawyers had coopered up a scheme on patents and tried to force us to take more patents than we needed and pay the royalties. And it just happened to be illegal. I wasn't a great genius to know that. And so we got down to setting up a meeting to meet. I fired off a telegram to him saying, I called your attention to such and such a decision of the United States Supreme Court. And at our meeting, I would like to have a discussion whether these patents are available individually or only as a package. And I knew that there could only be one answer to that. And when we went to Detroit, and we got exactly what we wanted. Well, the word came back to the executive committee and from the operating department saying, this guy pulled a miracle. And we were going down the drain, and all of a sudden, we come out winning. It sort of builds up one incident, and another, a third. People say, well, you know, maybe this guy is different than an ordinary lawyer, and maybe we ought to pay more attention to his views. And I can't point to any single day where suddenly it was all there. As a matter of fact, I never realized many of these things at the time they were happening. I was just doing my thing. And I didn't know, for example, that our F&F department had told the executive committee that I'd saved their bacon in Detroit. I thought it was a routine thing for a lawyer to do, and it worked. But from a business perspective, it meant a lot of money, and it had been accomplished without spilling any blood.
somewhere after you were on the executive committee, McCoy assigned each member responsibilities for specific departments.
Yes.
One of which you got was fabrics and finishes.
Yep.
And is that when you first met Heckert? Was he in charge there then?
No, this was before Heckert. Heckert came. Heckert was in the film department then.
Okay.
And then he moved over to F&F later on. But Dick and I go back a lot of years. Because I had the film department too.
Okay. Quoting here from a source that said you were getting an inside view of the workings of an operating department for the first time. What was your reaction to that? How did you feel about
well,
seeing
it? Well, I was looking for force credibility, and that meant the troops had to be convinced that the general manager wanted me in his act. And secondly, I really did want to understand the business better. You can't get legal advice out of context, and once you understood what their business objectives were and what their programs were, then you could start thinking in terms of what modifications will make any difference. Reaction to what goes on in the department, it was all very positive in the sense that I thought the heads of the department were really quite good. And it was their leadership that made the big difference. There were characters in some of the roles, and you had to know how to deal with them, but they could be dealt with. And never really had a problem. I had enough backing from the heads of each department that the others were responsive when I made recommendations. And, as a matter of fact, as I said, a lot of them simply saw me as a vehicle for testing out ideas and getting advice on non-legal problems. So, to put it a different way, if you were in private practice, you would spend years building your reputation, gradually getting a following. And the same thing happens in a business, a large business at least. People don't simply come to you because you're there. They come to you because somebody else said, he solved my problem, and get to him. He'll give you an answer. So it's really not different than private practice in that sense.
This was also the time of CorFan.
Yes.
And what was your involvement in the decision to pull the plug on it, as it were?
Well, I think that happened when I was on the committee, but it was an obvious answer that was long coming, and it really went to Dick Heckert to do the work and make the recommendation, and there wasn't any debate about it. The mistake in CorFan was that it came 10 years too soon. If CorFan had been invented 10 years later, I'm confident it would have been a huge success. It all turned on the price of hides. And then once the hide market went crazy, there was a great opportunity for CorFan-type products. But that's what goes on in business. You know, we once built a plant. Before we could open it, new technology had come and the plant was out of date. Those things are part of the risks of running a business. And the CorFan was a great pain, obviously, but we were all big boys, and you know what the risks are when you come up with a new development.
What was your agenda for the company when you took over in 74?
Well, that's a tough question because I no more than took over and we had the oil crunch and we fell into a deep recession. Suppliers unable to supply us with raw materials, people that we'd done business with for 30, 40 years simply refusing to ship. And one had to do what we could in terms of running the business. We had to conserve our capital because you couldn't foresee how long you would face this situation. And I remember we had lists of projects that were so important they simply had to be funded this year regardless. There were others that were projects that should be funded if there's available capital. And there were other projects that there's set out the list that said they're good projects, but they can keep for a couple of years without doing any serious harm. And we ran the business trying to allocate capital that way. On a broader basis, my objective was to open the windows, let the fresh air in, and change the atmosphere, change the public perception of DuPont. And that was accomplished without difficulty. Within the organization, not surprisingly, I sent out a signal that said, I'm not interested in what clubs you belong to, who your wife is, what family you come from. The only thing that's going to count is performance. And lo and behold, some people suddenly had careers that they didn't have before. You know, some would have just said, well, you don't want a Greek in that kind of a position. And I said just the opposite. You know, Greeks know how to make money. That's exactly the kind of fellow I want that job. And I put him in there, and he was immensely successful and ultimately wound up on the executive committee. So the atmosphere changed in the place in the sense that there was only one ground rule you had to pay attention to. Nobody cared about anything else. Now, I have to say that it took about a year before I could sense that the troops decided I was okay and they wanted to be supportive. Well, the first year, I think, they were doing what I told them to do, but you didn't get the emotional involvement response that you really want. And I understood that. It seemed to me perfectly clear that they had to get to know me before they could decide whether I was okay or not. But they did decide. And once they decided, then it was easy because what I did was to recognize right away that the worst thing that could happen to me is if I got isolated and heard only the good news that the troops wanted me to hear. And I thought that I was capable of making dumb mistakes from time to time. And so I got four fellows that I trusted. And I said, listen, you guys have got a job, confidentially. And that is, if you see me going off the deep end and come in and level with me fast, save me from making mistakes that I otherwise might make. And that happened. I had people come and say, Herb, you ought to rethink that one. And so I bought myself an insurance policy without having to pay a premium of any kind. The rest really flowed from how you dealt with the departments and their projects and their objectives, and how you dealt with lack of success when it happened, how you dealt with people who got themselves into trouble. We got an antitrust case that was unforgivable. We managed to get out of it all right, but one general manager retired very quickly. His number two man was given a non-commercial job, and the troops read the tea leaves saying right away that we wouldn't tolerate any funny business, and so we didn't have any, you know. For all the years after that, never had any antitrust problems. So it became, first for me, it was a problem of to make sure I knew what was really going on. I was not just getting good news. And I had my ability to wander around the corridors and talk to people and sort of get the lay of the land. And every once in a while, you picked up something that you wouldn't otherwise have known. But by and large, the objective was to be sure you had the right people and then turn them loose and get out of their way. Because the worst thing you can do is try to be a mastermind at the top office when it's simply not possible. You know, my function really was to deal with issues that the department heads couldn't solve for themselves. Occasionally, you had two departments contending for the same objective. Not so infrequently, something blew over the top and you sat down and said, okay, tell me the story. And you heard the story from both sides and you said, now, what piece of business is hanging on how we decide this question? Well, if nothing imminent, then why do we have to decide the question? Well, you know, it got started last year and it has to get resolved. Go on back to your offices, no decision. And that's the trick I learned from the Supreme Court when I was a young Supreme Court lawyer. The Supreme Court never decides constitutional questions if he can avoid it. There's a very wise wisdom behind that. And the same thing was true in business. Why decide academic questions? So, you know, it worked out fine. And I had the usual problems you have when you've got to tell one man that despite his aspirations, he's at the end of the road. Simply because there's somebody better available to fill that spot. Occasionally, you had to get tough with someone. But I've lost a few friends along the way that way. But that's what you get paid for. Decisions. And the nicest guys in the world sometimes are the wrong people for the assignment. And you've got to have the guts to step up to it. So I've had some experiences like that. But I think that's true in any business if you're doing the job. To resolve your doubts in favor of the man, but if you still got doubts when you're through, you know you've got to make a move. And try to do it as painlessly as possible, but men's careers were at stake. The thought of going home and telling his wife that he'd flunked out to pretty serious stuff. And they were always painful. You're always worried about whether you had made a mistake. But what you had to do once you thought your judgment was, and that's that. And a lot of those people have since become friends again, but some have not. And you know, that's just part of the territory.
You commented that one thing you had to do was find the right talented people and
yes.
Let them go. How do you select the right talented person? What do you do to find that person?
Well, first, you look for intellectual capacity. And without that, there's no point in playing the game at all. Then you look for the ability to solve problems and make things happen. And you found people who had done that, but they got to a certain level and the management said they've peaked out at this level. And finally, what you do is take one of your best operators and say, take this guy out of your wing. And after 6 months, tell me what you think of him. And I'm thinking of a particular case where the word was that man had topped out, and I assigned him to a man who later became a member of the executive committee. He came back and said, if I can have him, I want this man on my team. I think he's tremendous. And so he gave him a reprieve, and he turned out to do all kinds of important things in the company and rise much higher. And for some curious reason, somebody said, this guy's topped out. And so you keep looking for these hidden nuggets that are just mistakes in judgment by somebody. And it happens the other way, too. Some people got promoted who should never have been promoted. But the goal line is in discovering the talent that somehow or other was being missed. And, my favorite case is my Greek, because he performed beautifully in every assignment he had and retired from the executive committee when time came. I think of another man who they simply said is topped out, and he wound up being the profound thinker for the planning operations, dealing with what's the business going to look like 5 years from now, 10 years from now, what should we be doing now to get ready for those events. And that's not a man who's stopped out. So that was part of the fun of the job, really, the discovering talent. And what you learn is the obvious, that some people are glib and smooth, and they're not really solid performers at all. And that some people are very thoughtful, perhaps even too thoughtful in the sense of projecting themselves forward, because they're thinking all the issues, and there's a tendency to not see their strength because they don't sell themselves. And you look for who is the person who was built that way. And my test was usually to look at their writing. I could judge more from what a person wrote than I could from oral conversation. You couldn't fake it on paper. Leading in large businesses is really a people game, really. Early in my term, I spoke to a group of our scientists at our Philadelphia operations. After dinner remarks, you usually throw this thing open for Q&A. And you might, as you might expect, no one wants to ask the first question. And finally, a young Chinese scientist got up and said, "Mr. Shapiro, I mean no disrespect, but I would be interested in hearing you talk about why you think a lawyer, a non-scientist, should head the DuPont company." And I thought that was a marvelous question. I told him so. I said, "It's a great question. I've asked myself the same question. I'm going to tell you now what the answer is." And I took him through the job description for a CEO and reminded him that nobody expected the CEO to make inventions or to go on any but a few sales calls. His job was really one of dealing with facts, making decisions. And I said, all my years in a courtroom were years in which you're dealing with an irascible lawyer on the other side, you're dealing with a jury that may or may not be paying attention to you, you're dealing with a judge who may be able or not able, and he's making rulings, and you've got to make decisions on the spur of the moment as you go forward. And anybody who learns how to do that can learn how to make business decisions the same way. And in any event, I'm not sure I ever convinced him that a non-scientist could do the job, but that was my rationale, that if you looked at what the job of a CEO was, it was something quite different than running a laboratory or anything like that. If you're invited to the White House for a business session, what skills do you want? If you're dealing with press, what skills do you want? It's much more than the internal part of the business.
Which may have been necessary in the early days of the company, where the CEO would have been more involved in the internal part of the business, the chemistry that was going on, for example. But I think when companies mature and grow and become quite large, then that need, you, you have more layers between you and the operating.
Yeah, well, I think Bill, there's more to it than I think in the early history of DuPont. The family people, who were the key people in those days, really saw themselves as bankers. They assigned various areas of jurisdiction to talented individuals to run. And when any one of those people came in and said, we've built the business up to this level, we now need money to build another plant. You can make your case in about 15 minutes, and they'd say yes or no. And it was that simple. And sure, they visited with each other about new developments and research and products and all the rest, but they really saw themselves as not operating people. They saw themselves as a layer above that. And it was said, at least, that they would sit still even if they thought an apartment head was making a mistake. They wouldn't intervene and tell them not to do it. Well, I didn't see any sense in that. You don't want the mistake, period. But that was their state of mind. They saw themselves as bankers with funds.
What was it like operating, being CEO of a company in which a lot of power was in the executive committee?
It wasn't tough, because over the years you've built up enough procedures and systems so that by the time an issue got to the executive committee, you knew you were going to get all the relevant facts. And what you really got down to was a judgment about the sponsor of the project, the department head. How reliable had he been in the past? How much did he borrow on his facts? If he had a five-year forecast, what discount factor should you apply to it? And you had a different number for every one of those fellows who came in, because you were dealing in a world in which you were hearing only from proponents. In those days, DuPont didn't even have a planning group to provide the management with data that might counter what the proponents were offering. And that's one of the things I created. And has turned out to work very well. So in Congress, really in a large business, not to have a central planning group that kept the executive committee fully advised. I think the issues really were, first, are you satisfied on the facts? Is everybody satisfied? Secondly, do you want to put capital into this particular business? And sometimes the answer was no. I remember, just as an illustration, I ventured with a leading Mexican businessman, and the plan involved building plants in Mexico. We had to had an establishment in Mexico, but this was in addition to the joint venture. And one sole voice spoke up and said, "I disagree with you guys. I think this is the wrong thing to do," and he made his case. And by the time we got through talking, we agreed on a change of position. And then I drew the short straw flying down to Monterey and telling the proposed partner that they weren't going to have. And that's what made the system work, that you had a half a dozen people sitting around a room who saw each other every day, trusted each other, had respect for each other's judgment, and you tried to come to the best decision on the merits, and anybody's objection was entitled to be closely examined. There are times when you heard it, examined it, and said, "We disagree, and we'll go." But there were other times when someone waved the red flag and we had to start rethinking things. And sometimes, it happened to me from time to time, we'd wake up in the middle of the night and something would say, "You haven't gotten the right answer. You better rethink what you're doing." And I used to have a pad on my bedside. I'd jot down these ideas, some of which turned out to be wild when I woke up, but nevertheless, there was a mechanism inside that said, despite what you said, it's not the right answer and you ought to rethink. And usually when you did rethink, you came out with a different answer, and it was a better answer. And I can't explain that. I didn't even know the world of medical science to deal with that, but you knew when your gut judgment wasn't satisfied, and that gets you into the whole business of what is the gut judgment, and how do you know, and why is it different from your brain? But I think it is. I think you can rationalize a lot of things in your intellect, but your gut judgment won't be persuaded that way. And keep going away saying, "There's something else you've overlooked here, something there." Think it over again. I've never gone against my gut judgment that way. That's a warning sign. Better pay attention when that happens.
What was your relationship with Edward Kane?
What was it? Difficult. In a curious way, Kane thought he was going to succeed McCoy. And it came as a great blow to him to discover that he was not, and I did. And so, in the back of his mind, he was never quite happy with having to report to me. And there were days when he thought he had really been appointed and behaved that way. I had to have a heart-to-heart talk with him. Explained to him that there couldn't be two CEOs in this company. And either I was the CEO or I'd be gone. And I finally got him educated, but you know, this is a personal thing with one man who thought he had read the tea leaves and that the job was his. And the reality in the business world is there are no tea leaves. Either you're appointed or you aren't. So I understood what his problem was, but within limits you could tolerate it. Beyond those limits you couldn't.
during your term, there was a change in attitude about research and development.
Yes.
I have a few quotes here from Hanschel and Smith's book. One says that researchers interpreted the selection of a non-technical person to run the company as a de facto de-emphasis of research.
I think that's a lot of nonsense. Those people never talked to me when they did that book. They had selected sources, and as a matter of fact, I was fully committed to research for obvious reasons. 25% of our product line had been invented within the past 10 years, and so you knew that this was how you fed the business. This was how you distinguished DuPont from everybody else in the industry. And there was no issue about that. The issue I had to face was, given a lack of scientific background myself, I couldn't count on myself making all the right calls in the research world. And so we changed the system and said we're going to have a member of the executive committee with direct line authority over the entire research establishment. I appointed Ed Jefferson to that role. And that had a couple of great dividends. First, he got rid of the problem of researchers just researching something that they thought of, but which had no practical business worth. And you got people to focus on what the markets needed rather than just play around. And secondly, you had a central research group and you had research groups in each of the industrial departments, all of which worked separately. And all of a sudden you started exchanging data and working together on various projects. And it became, I think, a much more it was a more favorable atmosphere for getting research done. But well, I think the answer to the book is this simple. If you look at the money allocated for R&D, it kept going up. The last thing I would have wanted is to be a non-scientific person cutting back on research. It is the wrong signal. You can get that kind of literature if you're not careful about what the sources of the facts are. But, you know, if you look at it in pragmatic terms, I'm sitting there with five other members of the executive committee, all of whom came up through the research establishment. And it wouldn't take very long to have five guys in rebel calls if I tried anything as crazy as that. But the simple answer is that it didn't make any sense business-wise to go down that route. Matter of fact, I'm critical now of the current management for having cut their R&D expenditures. It seems to me that this is the lifeblood of the business. And if you don't have vigorous, strong, successful R&D operation, you're just giving up your future. You know, DuPont could not have lasted all these years but for R&D.
But wasn't there a period where, and I think DuPont did the same thing, you'll buy the new technology instead of, I mean, in recent years, you go out and buy a new technology as opposed to...
Well, I let me put it the other way. I think there was a time in history when you had a non-invented here, psychology, and people didn't want to pay any attention to what others were doing. They wanted it invented in their own shop. And I think DuPont finally outgrew that and said, if it's available elsewhere at a price that makes sense, we can use our research dollars for other research. And that happened. But it was a profound change from the non-invented here syndrome. But I don't think it had any significance at all in terms of a research program, because
got almost 5,000 researchers on the payroll at any point in time, and this is crazy if you don't want to be in the R&D game. I put it the other way. I think business acumen came to R&D.
Okay. One of the things you also did early in your tenure was to stress that there would be employment opportunities for minorities. And then,
yes, I went so far. Well, I made a discovery, first of all. I discovered that whatever I said publicly meant more to the organization than whatever we said in private communications. And so I simply went public and told the press that my objective was that by the time I retired, the presence of women and minorities in DuPont would be so commonplace that nobody would even talk about it. Now, it didn't quite happen that way, but it did open up a lot, and people still can't understand why there aren't, if there are five or six people, it isn't an executive committee, but if you had an executive committee of six people, I can't understand why three shouldn't be women. And there's no reason why they couldn't be, but the fact is that you get there only by accomplishment and the judgment of your peers that you deserve to be in that kind of a role. And you don't do it by counting gender or counting race or counting anything else. You want the half a dozen best people you've got.
Has there been women on the executive team?
No, not yet. There have been women in vice presidential roles, and inevitably it will. Well, there is no executive committee, so I can't answer that. Now you've got an office of the chairman, and they've got the chief financial officer, the chief personnel person, and the chief operating man, and the chairman. It's a question of a woman achieving that level. And no reason why it can't happen, but you can't speed it up. It's that simple. You've got to go through the steps and convince everybody that you're more able than somebody else. I don't think there's, don't really think there's any bias that affects it, because you've got Ed Woolard right now. He's got two daughters, no sons. He's very devoted to women's issues. If there was someone that he thought was ready to be chief financial officer, I assume she would get it. And Merck did that. They have a very able woman who is chief financial officer and a key person in the organization. So it can happen, but it depends on the luck of the draw in terms of your personnel. But I think Ward would give his right arm to be able to make that kind of appointment.
After you dealt with the energy crisis, which came soon after you started, I don't think I want to say any more about that, but that was certainly a trying time for all of the chemical industry.
Yes.
But later on in the 70s, the whole idea of competition, especially foreign competition, became a problem as well, didn't it?
Yeah, but the answer is that it worked both ways. We were doing more in Europe, other places, South America, other places in the world, and suppliers to those areas are coming more heavily into the United States and acquiring companies and competing here, and that's how it's worked out. ICI is a major factor in this country under a couple of names. The Japanese are the one exception. They haven't come here in a big way, Japanese chemical companies. But you'll find DuPont all over the world. It's not uncommon to come to a strange city and all of a sudden see a DuPont building. And so a revolution has really taken place. The world of the pre-war period is gone forever. And you're now seeing
two, three, four key companies in every product line being established all over the world and there wherever the market is. So it's a different, totally different marketing situation than we had before the war. And I think essentially it reflects aircraft and communications. The computer has changed everything. And even though it could be any place in the world, he'd be handling the business at his desk. And once that happens, it's a whole different world.
What will the effect of NAFTA and GATT have on the chemical industry?
Well, I'm not close enough to it to have any judgments of my own. Ed Woodard has been very enthusiastic about them in terms of how he sees the benefits of DuPont. And I think, at least on a theoretical basis, that's right. Anytime we've got the freedom to export without heavy duties, or the freedom to manufacture abroad and import to the United States or elsewhere, that involve the benefits. Now, you know, the real challenge is in the footnotes and things like that, not the concept. And if it works as intended, we've had one big office building in Mexico City called the DuPont Building, filled with Mexicans. I assume you'll have two or three before we're through. There's a whole market there to be developed. We've been at things in Mexico since 1909, but in a lot of areas there's regulation. You had to have a local partner. A lot of reasons why you limited yourself, and all that's gone now. And so I think you're going to see profound changes in world commerce. And you're probably going to see a smaller number of companies in each of the major markets, simply on the basis that if you can't be first or second or perhaps third, you can't really compete, because the large firms are going to have the capacity to serve those markets. Then you get, you know, the other problems you get. If you go to Japan, for example, you know you're going to be shut out of some markets, whether they admit it or not. But you learn to manage those problems. So I'm very enthusiastic about what's happening in the world. There are a lot of people who wring their hands and say you're moving jobs from the United States abroad. And it's true, you are moving some, but there are jobs coming here too. The ICIs in the United States and people who have lots of jobs. In a different world, it would be nice to debate whether to build our next plant in North Carolina or South Carolina. But in the real world, unless you're where the market is, you're not going to sell your product. And so that dictates that now you go to the Far East and establish manufacturing facilities there that will serve those markets. So there's change. Some people get hurt with change, and I think the worst offense is to entry jobs. As the sewing trade disappeared in this country, you have to remind yourself that that's how a lot of people started their working career, in the sewing trades. And they're going to be gone. You're going to have what you see now. The fabric cut here and shipped abroad to be sewed and then brought back. As long as the markets abroad are on a different cost level, people in this country have got no alternative but to do it, because they've got to be competitive. If they don't have a competitive product, they can't sell it. So you can't turn back the clock and say, we won't let things change. The trick, I think, is to recognize that change is inevitable and move with it as fast as you can to get the advantage.
You mentioned mentioned earlier that you had selected Ed Jefferson and you would eventually select him again.
Yes.
What was it about Ed Jefferson that caused you to select him for the to look over the research and development?
Well, that was an easy call. He was highly educated. He had had research background. He had run an operating department with its own research division, so that he was thoroughly familiar with the whole research establishment. And on top of that, I thought he had the guts to make the tough call, so he wouldn't just be a nice guy. And that was one of the decisions that worked out quite well. It's hard to realize that prior to that, each department was doing its own research thing its own way. The Central Research Department was a business for itself with no direct line of responsibility except to the executive committee. And common sense, as you look back on it now, says it probably should have been done a lot sooner. Well, I've seen inventions that were marvelous, but they didn't have any worth in the marketplace. And so, why did we do this?
Do you feel that there was reluctance on the part of the research community to accept these changes?
There was some in the beginning. There was an aura of independence that they wanted. On the other hand, there were a lot of researchers who recognized that they could play a much greater role in the success of the business if they had some focus on what the business needs were, what the market was after. And so you had mixed views, but having had independence for all those years, there were some people who thought that they had lost something when they got a leader from the executive committee. It didn't amount to anything, and they got used to the new system very quickly, and I think most saw it as a benefit.
You received the Chemical Industry Award in 1979, and I was going to ask you why you selected as a topic for your address to media as mirror, but you somewhat answered that already in terms of your opening, saying you want to be open to the media. What do you think has happened since 79 in the relationship with the media?
Well, we've lost some ground. I think that Dick Heckert was pretty good with the media, but I don't think Jefferson was, and I don't think Willard has been. And this is a strange phenomenon. Grown men become fearful of stuff that appears in the press, and they run from it. So they have somebody else deal with the media, and they've simply been unwilling to recognize that the credibility of the CEO does everything with the media. And once you send somebody else, you don't have that credibility. To this day, my relations with the media were such that to this day I hear from people. There'll be a piece in the New York Times this Sunday, and you ask, why are they doing anything about me? I'm out of the job 13 years. And some reporter thought that in the holiday period, they have a nostalgic, warm, fuzzy piece, and she remembered me, and she called up and said, we could talk to me. What people don't understand is that the media is crucially important to the success of the business. If you get a good press coverage, it makes a world of difference. If you're trying a lawsuit, if the jurors have read good things about your company, they have a different attitude toward the company. If you're in Congress testifying, and they read about you in the New York Times or the Washington Post, get a different reception. And that's certainly true with the government agencies. That's even true with your own people. They'll give you a little, for instance, over the objections of my PR people, I agreed to go on the talk show. Whatever the guy's name was. He's still doing talk shows. And it turned out very well from my standpoint, from DuPont's standpoint. And so the same people who urged me not to do it suddenly decided the tape of this needed broad dissemination among DuPont employees. And so they announced that they'd be running this thing at lunchtime for a couple of days in the Moore's Auditorium. And they were overwhelmed with people brown bagging it and watching the tape. So they sent it abroad to DuPont operations. You got the same reaction. I got letters from employees. I remember one particularly from a secretary. And she said, I knew about you. And I saw what came through officially, but I never could visualize you as a person until I saw that tape. And now I'm excited because I really relate to you, and I just want you to know that I'm a loyal DuPont employee, and I'm going to do everything I can to help DuPont achieve success. And what it says is your own people want to see you recognized outside the company. They want to see good coverage, and they read between the lines. If he's saying this, what does that mean inside the company? And as I said before, this is one mechanism for communicating with your people. It's a much more effective mechanism than sending out bulletins. And so, you know, without going overboard on the subject, I think you can't be in business without treating this as an important subject that needs attention. And John DeButz, when he ran AT&T, had a private line in his office, and he just told the press, if you want to know anything about AT&T, just call me on my private line. Don't bother with the PR people at all. And it worked marvelously. Everybody who called felt an obligation to that man, and when they could, they wrote something nice. So I didn't invent the concept, but I used it effectively and established my credibility. And it worked.
Could you say a little bit more about the Business Roundtable? You chaired it for 2 years, I believe.
Well, the Business Roundtable got started at the suggestion of Arthur Burns, who was then chairman of the Fed. And he told his business friends that he thought business was doing a terrible job in Washington, and that trying to deal with Washington through lobbyists was not a very good idea. And so a handful of businessmen organized something. And it really started out more as a labor relations operation than anything else. And when I came in, McCoy asked me to take his place on the policy committee of the roundtable, and I went to a couple of meetings and I told him, well, this thing wasn't going to work. These guys were much too confined in their outlook. Well, to make a long story short, we convinced people that the way you ought to function opposite government is through CEOs. And so only CEOs were members of the roundtable. And we're organized into little groupings, each one with a topic. Reg Jones of General Electric was the key man on taxes. He knew more about taxes than most of the people in Washington. And Russell Long, the chairman of the Finance Committee, he invited Jones down, and they spent an afternoon talking taxes. When Carter was going into the White House as president, Jones gave him a lecture on taxes. Each of us had a different field that we specialized in. And the objective was not to lobby in the traditional sense, but rather to be fact finders, to get all the facts on a given subject. Then sit to have the CEO, not his staff, sit down with the senator or the government agency, whatever it is, and say, here are all the facts. Now, here's the case for our point of view. Here are the answers to people who support a different point of view. But you've got all the facts now. And I've had more than one senator say, thank you. I've never before had the experience of someone lobbying me and giving me all the facts. Same thing at the White House. You always had collisions between government agencies and business interests, and trying to get them resolved at the White House level. And they'd bring in the agency head. And you've got someone speaking for the roundtable who has assembled all the facts and says, here, you know, let's agree these are the facts. Now let's talk policy. I'll give you a marvelous illustration. When Carter was running for president, the suggestion was made by Bob Strauss, who sort of followed industry activities. It would be nice to invite Carter to speak to the policy committee, the roundtable. And so I did it on the basis that anybody running for president certainly don't have access to this crowd. And he turned it down. And nobody's heart was broken. Most of the members were Republicans, and they're just being good guys. But in any event, Carter got the nomination, and then he called a meeting at a motel at the Atlanta airport, and I attended it. And it turned out there were 22 people, all of whom wanted something from Carter, and he turned them down. And so he now had them all in, and we had a luncheon, and we drew straws for positions, and each person was given 3 minutes to say anything we wanted to say to the nominee and his lieutenants who were there. And as fate would have it, I drew number 11. And I listened to all these other people make pitches about their self-interest one way or another. And I just started by saying, Governor, I want to tell you about the Business Roundtable. I have to tell you right off, most of the members of the Roundtable are Republicans. But we do have access to facts and knowledge about a lot of subjects that might interest you during the campaign. And I want to volunteer that if you would find it helpful, we would be glad to put together position papers on any subjects that you ask for. And he snapped at that right away and said, that's a good idea, let's do it. And he turned to Bert Lance, who was seated next to him, and said, work it out with them. Well, make a long story short, we got a list of 9 topics, and in 2 weeks we delivered 9 position papers, objective on all the facts, and then stating our views of what we thought the right answer was. Now, I don't know whether Carter ever read any of those papers, but he remembered that the roundtable had offered him help, and I'm sure his staff people had read the papers. And so when the administration formed, the roundtable people were right at the front seat with a chance to express views, with a chance to nominate people for serious consideration for appointments. And as a matter of fact, he had me picked out as a serious contender for Secretary of the Treasury. And I had to do a little dance to get him turned off, because I didn't want to be in a posture of saying no to a president. The other dividend from all this, which was unintentional but which was very important, was that we discovered very quickly that CEOs didn't know much about the political system, how it functioned, what was important to it, how to deal with it. And we were really running a course for CEOs on how to deal with the external world. And I'll give you one illustration again. We had organized an arrangement with the Speaker of the House to meet with him twice a year with his key lieutenants to address various subjects that they thought were interesting to them. And the first session went so well that instead of lasting an hour, it lasted all afternoon. But when it was over, we got word from the Speaker. He said, you had a man who reported on the oil industry, but he reported by reading a paper to us. He said, you should understand that you don't read papers to members of the House. Okay, we understand you, and we appreciate the good advice. We brought the same man back for the next round, and he just sat there and talked off the top of his head, supposedly, no papers at all, and came through fine. Everybody learned a lesson. You wouldn't think of it right away that people in the Congress would prefer that you not read something to them. Yet when you reflect on it, you can understand why. So we did 2 things. We educated business itself. Secondly, we acquired skills in terms of lobbying the government in a positive way. And we got our voice heard. A lot of things didn't happen because people listened to us. For instance, there was a movement afoot to create an Office of Consumer Affairs to supplement everything else that the government has. And it made no sense at all in practical terms, but it was a political thing. And so we sat down with everybody who would listen and said, if with the establishment you have in place now, you think their consumer affairs problems are not being resolved, why do you think creating another agency will make it any different? And finally, they recognized the reality and backed away from it. And at the start, Nader had that thing at a boiling pitch. So, net-net, the ability to get your voice heard on the merits is crucially important to every business. And to this day, I can go down to the Senate, to the House, and people will remember me and will listen. I don't have to do it anymore, but they learn who they can trust. And indeed, we've had the experience that if you bring a CEO down, I brought Crawford Greenough all down once, and he saw certain people and didn't see certain others. And the ones he didn't visit were insulted that he didn't give them attention to. Well, once I learned they felt that way, that mistake was never made a second time. So, you know, the issue is, how do you communicate effectively, and lots of times it's not by writing a letter or making a phone call. It's by sitting across from each other and making sure that all the facts are on the table, and then making your argument. And you win converts that way.
Another problem that you faced was twofold. One, going in opposite directions. One was a declining public image of chemistry in the chemical industry, and the other was an increasing government regulation system.
Well, the two had some relationship. Long government agencies thought the public saw the chemical industry in a negative way. They were encouraged to throw the book at the industry. And so it was the Phil Donahue show I was trying to think of earlier. And the reason for going on that show was that I could get an hour of commercial television time to espouse the views of the DuPont company without spending a nickel. And there was a gamble involved. But the fact that it was received very well meant that lots of people had a new view about DuPont. Now, the same thing is true with these public policy questions. Unless you educate the public, you're not going to get far in Washington. You can't deal with these problems by simply using political connections and saying, I gave money to the Republican Party, therefore I'm entitled to be heard. They'll receive you, be gracious to you, but nothing will happen. And you've got to convince people on the merits that these are sensible people with a rational point of view, and you ought to be able to work with them. And one experience, just to divert again, there was an environmental issue, and EPA was going off in one direction at a full gallop, and we thought they were wrong in what they were doing. We raised the issue with one of the president's staff people, and she said, well, let me get the administrator in and we'll talk together. And everybody applauded that, and we had a series of sessions at the White House trying to find common ground. And then, lo and behold, there was an election, and Carter lost. And the people in industry who were naive about the political world assumed that now that Carter had lost, they didn't have to worry about this problem. The Republicans would bail them out. And that was sheer nonsense. And so some dropped out of the working group at the White House. The rest of us went through with it. We got a package that everybody could live with. And Congress enacted it. And when the president signed it, in his signing message, he explicitly recognized the fact that this legislation couldn't have been obtained without the cooperation of the chemical industry. Well, that's what you're up to. But obviously, if there is a fundamental problem of some kind with a product, you can't paper it over by talking. But most of these issues are not of that nature at all. They're the issue of, if the water is 98% pure and someone wants it 99% pure, and everybody can drink the 98% water and swim in it and everything else, is it prudent to spend $100 million on the water rather than use that capital to build a plant or provide jobs? And it's those kind of arguments where you have to get your point of view heard. And interestingly, the newest justice of the Supreme Court did three Harvard lectures on that very subject, which are now out as a book. And his conclusion was that most of what we had done was mistaken. It was a waste of resources, and we didn't attack the real problems. And so, what you're talking about is not anything that is inherently evil. but rather judgment calls on whether the line should be here or here, and how to make the right call. Bear in mind that you're usually dealing with young people, not a lot of experience. They've got good hearts, and they've got thoughts about what they want to do in the way of a contribution, but they're lacking experience, they're lacking access to key facts, and if you can establish a rapport in which you can get your side heard, you can make progress. You know, it's like you're up and down all the time, there's no question about it, depending on who's in office and what the PR of the thing is. Half of the things that happen, obviously, happen because it's good press, not because of a fundamental problem that needs addressing. But nonetheless, that's the world you live in, and you have to learn to function in that world.
An article in CNN News, 1979, I believe it was an interview with you, and you spoke of a number of antitrust suits against DuPont at that time. You said we were being used as a guinea pig.
Well, I'm not sure I spoke in the, I don't really remember that, but I'm not sure I spoke in the present tense rather than the past tense. There were a number of antitrust suits against DuPont in the 40s. That's when I was recruited to come. In the early 50s I came. There was a time when DuPont had 10 antitrust suits tending against it, and the line always was, we have as many antitrust suits as we have honors from the Defense Department. You know, they gave you some kind of a symbol in those days, and DuPont was large, and it didn't deal with the subject very adroitly, and the antitrust division enjoyed bringing the cases. But what we did was simply, I didn't do it, but they did it at the time, adopt a policy of not settling any of the cases, litigate every one. And they won a fair number of the trials. And all of a sudden, the antitrust division lost interest in DuPont because it wasn't an easy win. Now, we didn't have a slew of antitrust suits in the 50s at all. The last one I remember was the trial of the Sullivan case in the early 50s, and we won that.
When you reached retirement in 1981, how did you look back at what you might say would be your legacy to the history of the company?
Well, I was quite pleased with myself for two reasons. The first was that I had presided in a transition period from the DuPont family to skilled managers, and I did it without spilling any blood. That meant a lot of hand-holding, a lot of consulting, a lot of convincing people that we ought to raise the dividend and all those sorts of things. But I operated to preserve the role of the DuPont family, the historic role, without having them really interfere with management of business, but solved it by communication. No surprises, therefore no problems. And that's one of those unrecognized things that I think turned out to be very important. On the other side, we had come from rock bottom in the 74-75 period when you had the oil crunch, to the fact that the business was running quite well in the late 70s, and I finally decided I was a businessman too. I think the final statement I'd make on that would be that in every business, the first order of business for a new CEO is to be prepared with his successor, and to recognize that most of what you do is going to redound to your successor, for good or for bad. And so when I retired and we had a succession, everybody thought was fine, that was a load off my back. I thought I had accomplished it. Now, I think just in the privacy of this room, I did it upside down, but that's something I learned with. If I do it all over again, I would have moved Heckert first. Gave my Heckert more time in that job, but that's the kind of wisdom that comes late.
Had you thought when you retired that you would really retire as opposed to ending up with many other activities on your plate?
Well, the answer to that is this simple. In 1979, I bought a house in Florida. I said, when I retire, I'm going to spend more time down here and take life easy. And the closer I came to retirement, the less I thought of that idea. And then that was encouraged by lots of phone calls. Suddenly, law firm discovered me, and everybody wanted to bring me in as a partner in New York and Washington. Some offered to open offices here. And it suddenly dawned on me that, well, if I was that attractive, maybe I ought to take a few years of it and make a few bucks. And I finally decided I'd do it for 3 years and retire at age 68. Well, 3 years has come and passed, and I'm still at it. And I guess the honest answer is that this is more fun than anything else I can do. Once you've got a pension, you stop worrying about supporting yourself, and you do the things that turn you on. And I discovered that a client with a problem is a lot of fun, and solving the problem is a great thing. You get a great charge out of it. And making money is even nice. But I hate to get up with the idea that I have to go play golf every day. I sort of like the idea of coming in and you got a crisis today. Well, all right, let's work the problem and see where we come out. This shop, most of the people here have parents who are the ages of my children. And so they can't figure me out at all. I'm just from a different world. But they're respectful, and when I bring in some business for them, they appreciate that. But, you know, these are all bright kids in their 20s and 30s.
Recently,
a company wanted to take its stock public, so they retained us to prepare the proxy material and file it for public distribution, which is a major undertaking. Very often you get situations in which there's a conflict between two companies, and you really need someone to sort out the facts and say, here is the issue. I want you guys to sit down yourself and see if you can't solve it, rather than spend a lot of money having us litigate it in a courtroom. And 9 times out of 10, they solve the problem themselves. So, in a very real sense, I'm a problem solver. I no longer go to the law library and research law. I couldn't keep up with the kids who are better trained than I am. But I'll give you a different kind of person. I got a call one day from a lawyer I knew very casually, and said, I've got a client that needs your kind of experience. Can I bring him to see him? I said, sure, come ahead. Well, it turned out he was a man who had inherited a minority interest in a major newspaper. And the majority interest kept the dividends low and kept the stock price low. And so this fellow could never live the life he wanted because he never had access to his capital. There was no market for the stock. And so the trick was to figure out a way to get him cash for his stock. And that involved some litigation, some discovery materials, and ultimately conducting an auction to sell a minority interest in this newspaper. Post and Gannett came in as bidders, and we got the man more money than he ever dreamed he would see, and it all happened because I could go to an investment banking firm and say, I got a client who's cash poor, but he's got this asset, we can work it so that we can sell the stock, we'll get paid. If we can't, there's not much money here because this guy's just barely eking out a living. And the investment banker said, well, we do a lot of work together, we'll take a chance. And we accomplished it. And we had a dinner in New York for this man and his family. And it was fascinating just to listen to it because he had a very talented daughter who had an important position in Washington with one of the accounting firms. Her husband was a medical researcher at the NIH. And of all people, he's the one who spoke up at the dinner and said, I want you to understand what this means. We were about at the point where I was prepared to resign from the NIH and go out to make money because we've got children that I have to go to college. Now, I don't have to leave NIH. I can do my research work at NIH, and there'll be enough money for all of us to live our lives. Well, you don't think about those things every day, but seeing a family this way gives you a nice sense of comfort that you've done something constructive. I had a call a couple of months ago from a doctor in this town who said, I'm in trouble, I need your help. I go, well, come on down, I'll buy a lunch and tell me. Well, he's a specialist, and most of his patients are DuPont employees or DuPont pensioners. DuPont changed its health care coverage to a different company. That company came into town and selected a group of physicians as its authorized physicians, and he didn't hear about it until late in the game, and when he heard about it, he went to them and asked to be put on the list as an authorized physician, and said, no, it's too late. And so he took the appeal to Philadelphia and what have you. Turned out all the way. So he came in, I want to sue them. They're going to put me out of business. And it's a real dilemma. It happens to a lot of doctors, and it's a real dilemma. And I said, well, the first thing I got to do is check to see whether our firm has represented that insurance company, because if they have, I'm disqualified from representing it. And I checked, and sure enough, we've done a lot of work for that insurance company. But instead of signing off, what I did is call the partner of the firm who represented the company and said, yeah, here's the dilemma. I said, why can't you talk to somebody you know in that company and get them to be sensible? Putting this one doctor on the list isn't going to make any difference to them, and it makes an enormous difference to the man. So he said, let me talk to the people at the client, and I'll call him back. And he called back and he said, I want you to call, no, I want you to have your client call so-and-so, who's chief of healthcare operations in the legal department. And he doesn't want any lawyers involved, so don't you get on the phone, don't have anybody on the phone except your client. So I went out and sat down with my client and said, Doctor, now do what I tell you this time, don't get off the reservation. Don't call this afternoon. Call first thing in the morning when they're fresh. And tell your story and see what happens. Well, the answer was they put him on hold for 10 days and then called up and said, you're in. And if we had sued, we'd still be litigating. I didn't make a nickel out of that, and I didn't want to. But here was a fine doctor, who was my own doctor, as a matter of fact, and who would have been really destroyed financially if we hadn't solved the problem. I got a tremendous charge out of doing something like that. All was involved was a phone call. But having the ability to call the right person, get something to happen, is the whole ballgame. So, you try to get all the business you can, do all those things, but down deep you know that that's not really what you're after. You're after the ability to use your skills in a constructive way. A few months ago, the governor called up and said, I got to have you meet. Why? Well, GM has announced they're going to shut down the plant here. And that's 3,600 people out of jobs. A lot of suppliers out of business as well. And we've got to get organized to take steps to have the state respond as best we can. Well, I said, all right, I'll take it on. And we'll do the study and get the facts on one condition. And that is that you don't demonize General Motors. Don't start on the premise that they're evil and we're going to correct evil. Instead, start on the premise that they're fine businessmen. We've had them in Delaware for a lot of years. And economic circumstances may be forcing their hand, but we want to work with them. Well, to make that story short, they did a number of things, including organizing the small business manufacturers in the state. And they found 200 truly exciting businessmen that I had never heard of. But the people that started up businesses and grew them. Had one fellow who started working with DuPont, had his own business, and he was doing business all over the world, and 200 employees. Long story short, we got the state organized to improve its practices with respect to manufacturing in the state. And secondly, we maintained our relationships with General Motors in such a way that when the automotive market turned up, they came back and said, hey, we're not going to close the plant in 96, as we'd said. You can't put that on the books anyplace, but the fact is that by doing it the right way, we accomplish something. Get satisfaction out of that. It's a lot better than hitting a bad drive on a golf course.
Do you still golf?
I quit this year. It got worse and worse as we got older. And my wife and I looked at each other one day and said, why are we torturing ourselves? We're not having fun anymore. And so we thought, all right, let's call it quits. No point in making your body do something it can't do well. And as a matter of fact, I just got a check from my club this week getting a refund on my membership.
Well, I know we've taken up quite a bit of your time this morning. I have just a couple more questions if you have time.
You've got me until you're out of gas.
Okay. 1985, you wrote a book with someone, I think, from DuPont. From DuPont. America's Third Revolution.
Yeah.
Why at that point did you decide to write that book?
Well, I let myself get talked into it. I had made a series of speeches on various public policy issues and business, and people came around and said, you know, you really ought to convert those speeches into a book. And then Harper came in and said, we'd like to publish it. And that was too tempting to walk away from. I'm not sure if I had my life to live over again, I would have written the book. It was very successful on college campuses. The rest of the world didn't give a damn about it at all. But I can go up to the Kennedy School, and I'm a big name there because they got the book. You don't realize what you're really getting into when you write one of these things if you can do it well. It was a major undertaking. I wouldn't regard it as a financial success, although I had no financial stake. Since it involved the speeches I'd done at DuPont, the royalties were set to go to DuPont.
And then we come to Howard Hughes Institute, which...
Well, that's a different world entirely. And I might add, it's the second time in my life where, as a non-scientist, I'm running an operation that depends on scientists. Howard Hughes, it's a long story. When Hughes died, there were three of his retainers who sort of saw themselves as the executive committee at the Howard Hughes Institute. And there was Hughes' nephew who didn't buy that at all, so he brought a lawsuit against these people, challenging their authority to run the Institute. In the meantime, these three guys decided they'd better bring some fresh blood in if they're going to have any respectability. And so they got my name, a retired dean of the Harvard Business School, and propositioned me. And I said I was interested, but not while they were in litigation. If they got that resolved, I'd consider doing it. After a trial, the judge ruled that these guys were not authorized, and since there was no one authorized, the court would appoint a board, and he appointed 8 trustees, left 1 vacancy to be filled by the 8, and each side submitted names for consideration, and lo and behold, my name survived. And so I got involved with this thing as a trustee, and was appalled at what I found. They were running a decent science program, but their business affairs were simply chaotic. They were engaged in a long-term fight with the IRS dating to 1969. Penalties were accruing some huge sum per day. I took one look at that and said, well, first thing we're going to do is make peace with the IRS. We can't live with these kind of penalties because ultimately we'll be out of business if we continue this. And so we recruited a first-rate staff of tax experts, then went to the IRS and said, it's a whole new ballgame. People you've been fighting with are gone. They're really not gone. They're part of the trustees, but they're surrounded by new trustees. And it's a whole different ballgame. And over a period of a year, year and a half, we proved that to them. And we worked out a settlement that was quite satisfactory. And so we solved our IRS problem. And then, well, at the same time, I recognized that here was a medical research operation of quite some significance that was dependent on dividends from a single company. And if that company ever had a bad year, the research program was in difficulty. And so we made the same decision. the Ford Foundation made, and they took the Ford shares public, and we said we're going to sell the Howard Hughes airplane company and use the proceeds to finance medical research. Well, sometimes you have to have divine guidance, and we happen to pick a period when that industry was at its peak in the market. And we ran an auction and got over $5 billion for the company from General Motors. And there are two other bidders, Boeing and Ford, close to them. And suddenly, we had independence. We could have a diversified portfolio. That $5 billion is now close to $8 billion. And we're putting out about $350 million a year in medical financing. But most of it is medical research, but about $50 million is grants to various institutions to encourage the study of science. Some museums even. But we found, for example, a black school in New Orleans in which 90% of its graduates go on to graduate work. And most of them in medicine. And so you go down and say, what's going on here? And they tell you their story. And it's a simply marvelous story. And you say, could you find a use for $2 million more a year? And they kiss your feet. And what you find is that they've gone out and recruited among the black community in the South the talented kids they could find, got them to the school, made them into something, educated them, and turned them on so that they want to do something with their lives. And they're all going to medical school. So we're putting out about $50 million for things like that, museums and scholarship money for some students in medical school and a number of programs of that sort. So it's about $50 million is a foundation, in a foundation mode, and about $300 million running medical research laboratories. This has turned out to be an exhilarating experience. Again, I sit at science meetings. I can't understand very often what's being said. Once turned to the man behind me, he said, you know, I don't have any science in my background. I didn't understand that. And he said, Herb, I'm a physician, and I didn't understand it either. And the answer, of course, is that it's such new stuff. With such new language that unless you're in your 20s or early 30s, you're lost. But it's a thrilling experience to see these bright young people come in, take on research assignments, and then report on them. And almost every week, you're getting another discovery, another gene defective that causes this or that. The most recent one was the one at Rockefeller, where he found the gene that relates to fat. Well, that was a huge scientist. And next week it'll be something else. I'm living in a sort of a dream world. When I sit down at meetings, there are a couple Nobel laureates at the same table, and the very brightest of the medical people in the country and Canada are serving on our committees, and we're trying to use money in a very constructive way. And it's being recognized in the scientific circles that Hughes is making quite a difference in the world. And just to show you how things go, we discovered that the scientists in Eastern Europe are starving. They can't get funding. Some are getting jobs as cab drivers or anything, just to live. And we discovered that for $10,000, you could hire a top-drawer scientist with his staff, and they would take care of his expenses in his laboratory, too. And so we run a contest, really, in which we've selected a group of scientists in all through Eastern Europe, and I named them Hughes scientists, and they'll get money grants to keep them in business. Now, I don't know who's going to make the next great discovery, but it could very well be one of those people. And the thought of it, that for $10,000 a laboratory went down, makes you worry about things. And so we're trying, and we're having great success, and that takes a fair amount of my time now, but I guess I average about a day a week, but it's a real challenge, and the thing that turns me on is, apart from the goals, is using the skills I developed. I don't have to make medical decisions, but I knew how to recognize problems with the IRS, and problems with management of the place, and how to get that straightened out, and how to manage it properly. And so, it's an interesting activity that I wouldn't have counted on, but there it is.
You mentioned management. You once wrote an article in which you said that management cannot be reduced to a science.
That's right. You're dealing with judgment. You can't reduce your life to any mathematical formula. And our judgment calls all the time make the difference. Management knows it's going to make mistakes. Very often they're mistakes because you never have all the facts when you need them. But you've got to make a decision. And the judgment calls are the guts of any successful enterprise. My definition of success is being right 51% of the time. There's nobody who's smart enough to call all these shots and call them all right. But good management will be more successful, and it will face up to the fact that it has made mistakes when it makes a mistake. And that's the difference between successful companies and less successful companies. Quality of judgment.
Isn't that what the chemical industry did originally, after Rachel Carson and Silent Spring? They stonewalled for a while before they realized that they had to be more honest about what was happening.
Yeah, that's right. And then that was one of the jobs that Dick Heckert got from us. We sent him down to Congress to teach him about cancer. I can't remember the issue now, but there was some claim that cancer was all over the place. And Dick went down there and called on everybody and gave them a little lesson on what is cancer and what is not cancer, and changed perceptions on what the problem was. But I can't remember whether it was the LR thing on apples or whether it was something like that, but it was one of those affairs where there was no real problem, but an issue had been built up to the point where people were scared. When you said cancer, people thought of death, and they would do anything. And it was Dick's job to go down and talk turkey with him in terms of what cancer is and what it isn't. Given his big figure and his manner, he was very effective talking the straight way he does, and persuading a lot of people that they're simply misinformed. Yeah, there's been a lack of wisdom in the industry from time to time, no question about it. And in the earlier days particularly, it was often based on political considerations, and anybody who knew would recognize that writing a check is no guarantee of anything, and yet they naively thought it was.
Well, I've sort of come to the end of my question list. Do you have anything else that
you got tired, huh?
Well,
I'll make you a proposition. We're serving a luncheon today downstairs for our lawyers, If you were interested, the three of us could slip down there and grab a platter, sit off in a corner by ourselves and not interfere with them, and you'd get a good meal.
All right, we'll take you up on that.
Let's go. Let's go before they shut it down.
Thank you for spending time with us this morning.
Oh, I appreciate it.
Thank you.